You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, a geriatric road trip in pursuit of $1 million, plus a Beat Generation murder mystery. We take stock of the latest film releases to hit the cinema screens.
Are you threatening my family?
Everybody's saying how Woody Grant's a millionaire.
That's no big deal.
No big deal? Jeez.
A clip of the brilliant Nebraska there. We'll also be asking what to make of the latest exhibition at the Kunstwerke Contemporary Art Center in Berlin.
Schlingensief certainly had his haters, but his work was never boring. I don't always love his trashy aesthetic, but when I see evidence of the 3 decades in which he shook up German culture, I realize the hole his absence has left.
Plus, as Monocle's Christmas market is now in full swing, we'll be inviting a couple of our friendly stallholders into the studio to share some music with us and the cultural scene from Beirut.
So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to a very busy, very cheesy smelling,
very
Midori
festive,
house. Very beautiful. It is the Monocle Christmas Market, as Gillian has just said. Now in full swing, we will be inviting a couple of our friendly stallholders, as you've just said. Will we be inviting the reindeer?
No, I think not. But we had a little preview of the reindeer. And this year, oh, he's so beautiful. And he has his hay there and Santa just kitty corner next to him. And we fly in a real life Santa.
A real life Santa. There is only one, Gillian.
The real life.
He's here. He's here. His beard is magnificent, ladies and gentlemen. It's worth the trip to London just to see Santa's beard. Actually, it's just worth to see Santa. So we are having a nice festive feeling here at Monocle 24. It's super busy. There's a lovely weekend feeling. Lots of families are here.
But
lots of smartly
nice,
dressed weekenders. It's really nice.
What's nice about it is it's all our readers and our contributors and people who've written for us and people who we've interviewed, people who live in the neighbourhood. It has this great atmosphere, and the stalls this year I think are wonderful because it's a mix of some of our old favourites and some new ones, including the vintage stall holder.
We have a vintage stall holder. They have taken some of my money already, and I don't think the fair has even opened. We have Koss here, which is lovely. It's a new addition. We have lovely Nancy Durham and her marvellous lavender product, and we have the Lebanese contingent will be in here later on to
exactly.
Tell us more and also to give us a cultural overview of what's happening in Lebanon at the moment. So, a busy time here at Midori House, both inside the studio and outside too. Let's talk about film.
And of course, we love to go to the movies here at Monocle 24, but with so many films and so little time, we like to have a little professional guidance.
We welcome back journalist Alex Godfrey to talk us through some of this week's new releases and ask you whether you're going to be tempted by a cheese sandwich at a cheese on toast raclette at the Monocle Christmas market. Alex.
Yeah, I might maybe have 2 or 3.
Okay. You've been to the cinema?
A few times. What's it like
in there, Alex? What are we going to start with?
Nebraska.
Okay, tell us what it's like.
It's a lovely film by Alexander Payne, who did Sideways and The Descendants and a couple of others. And it's about an old man who's clearly suffering from a bit of dementia, and he thinks he wins £1 million on some lottery sweepstakes, and he wants to go and collect his winnings.
That's a very simple way of describing it, but it actually is not the collection of the winnings that's the point of it. It becomes this very beautiful road trip between father and son.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's really about a family getting to know each other. It's a great relationship, and it gives you a very similar feeling to Alexander Payne's other films. You know, it's very wry and very funny and very gentle, but it's got a real serious backdrop, really.
I love the concept because there are so many scammers that aim themselves at old age people. And, you know, there's so many people who do receive, they open up the envelope and they think they've won $1 million. And with that comes hope. But with hope comes so many things that it's the Pandora's box, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this film is about, I guess as much as anything, it's about everyone else's reaction to that. And it's, you know, like you were saying, it's not about the money in the slightest, but it's about how people deal with that. And it's a great relationship road movie.
It has a wonderful, what I quite enjoyed about it when I saw it was not the fact that the two main protagonists, the father and son, are hell-bent on claiming this money. They seem to be the last people at all actually interested in what life will be like with $1 million. But everybody who they encounter on this journey suddenly, automatically and quite naturally decides to try to claim a slice of the pie. And some of it is done in quite a sinister manner, but others are done in just totally comic methods as well.
Yeah. He goes back, doesn't he, to his town, to the small town where he's come from, and it reopens a lot of wounds, and there's a lot of classic conflict in it. It's a brilliant film.
What's wonderful, it seems, is this isn't about stars, but it's about great performances.
Yeah, Bruce Dern, who, I mean, you know, he's a legend of sorts, and he did some great films in the 70s, King of Marvin Gardens and Coming Home. I think a lot of young people might not know who he is, but you can just see he's got old Hollywood all over him. And the fact that he was cast in this and how they do, and it's black and white, and they used the old Paramount logo at the beginning of the film, so it's clearly referencing, you know, the golden age. And he's just so amazing in it. I think he's 77. Somehow in this, he looks about 177.
Let's have a listen to a little clip from Nebraska.
So you told the sheriff that you were walking to Nebraska.
That's right. To get my $1 million.
God damn, Woody grabs a millionaire. That crown is on Woody.
If Woody hit it rich and I don't see any of it, that would be wrong.
Are you threatening my family?
Everybody's saying how Woody Grant's a millionaire.
That's no big deal.
No big deal? Jeez. Million here, a million there. Well, the newspaper's gonna do a big write-up on you.
Honestly, right? Woody didn't win anything.
You're a damn liar.
Hey.
A little clip of Nebraska there. Alex, I found the film a perfect tonic to a hard week, actually. I sort of slumped in the cinema on a Friday evening and found the pace of it really soothing and satisfying and just so beautifully measured. Initially, I thought it was quite wooden, but then I actually realised, no, this is the way that the pace is intended to be beautifully, beautifully slow.
Yes, it's very comforting. It is very soothing. I mean, just the look of it and the feel of it. And, you know, it's a film of lots of old people on it being really, really interesting. You don't see it enough. You know, it's not gimmicky. It's just a great... I mean, all Alexander Payne's films are character-driven. And it's, in a sense, I think the vague plots that he has are really there just to prop the people up so we can hang out with them.
What were you left thinking? Is there a message to this film?
I hope not. I think on one side it explores the fact that the son finds out lots of interesting things about his dad and finds out that he had quite an exciting, interesting and exotic life. I mean, you know, there's that side of it, which is he's not just an old guy, he's not just a dad. Look at the effect he has or had on this town. You know, it's a family film, I think, more than anything else. I don't know if there's a message. I hope there's not a message as such. But, you know, it's really
about... thought-provoking.
Yeah, and it's about, I think it's what Alexander Payne does best. It's about how people relate to each other.
Yeah, and it has a lovely triumphant ending as well. Small triumph, but has profound consequences. Yeah. It's lovely. Let's move on to another film, Kill Your Darlings. Daniel Radcliffe, he of that little wizard film, or those little wizard films, excuse me, a film which is focusing on the Beat Generation.
Mm.
Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, it's about many things. It tries to do quite a lot. It's about the Beats coming together at Columbia University, you know, Kerouac and Ginsberg and Burroughs. It's also a kind of coming-of-age story. There's a lot of seduction in terms of the writing and sex and music. There's murder in it. I mean, it's all based on truth, obviously, and lots of frenzied jazz playing and feverish typewriting.
You say it was based on truth. I gather that Kerouac and Burroughs did write a book called And the Hippos Were Born. Boiled in their tanks. It is a small footnote, but it is a very interesting story at the sort of beginnings. Can you talk a little bit about the story?
What side of it?
Of the film.
About the murder story?
Yeah, well, the film, what the film's about.
Well, you know, Ginsberg meets all these people who show him how exciting writing can be and how naughty everything is, you know, and Ginsberg falls in love with Lucien Carr. Ginsberg is played by Daniel Radcliffe. He falls in love with Lucien Carr, who is played by a great actor called Dane DeHaan. And he's taken into this world of beat writing and jazz. And Lucien keeps bumping into a sort of former mentor, stalker, who all gets a bit sticky and sweaty. Mm.
Let's have a quick listen of Kit to Kill Your Darlings.
Are you a writer? Because I've got a job for a writer.
Rhyme, meter, conceit. Without this balance, a poem becomes slack.
Then how do you explain Whitman? Well, he hated rhyme and meter.
What's your name?
Allen Ginsberg.
Allen in Wonderland.
Allen.
Willie.
The Burroughs family is richer than God.
Oh, he looks like a criminal.
Tear him up, boys. Destroy the old and build the new.
To literacy. Literacy.
You don't know Lou. As soon as you think you do, he'll find someone else.
Jack!
Maybe he already has.
A clip of Kill Your Darlings there. Alex, Daniel Radcliffe in the lead role. How satisfying and successful is that?
He's fine. You know, he's...
That's a really...
He looks a little bit like a grown-up Harry Potter.
Is that damning with faint praise?
No, he's fine in it. I mean... I think he's getting better all the time, and he's very watchable, and he's quite convincing in it. It's just a solid performance, and there's something very warm and likable about him. I don't think he burns up the screen, and I think he's overshadowed by some more exciting actors in some more exciting parts in that film. But I think that's kind of the point of it. But no, he's good. I mean, it'll be interesting to see where he goes. He's obviously choosing very interesting roles, and you know, he's trying to get away from Harry Potter. In a sense, not in the way that Macaulay Culkin did and sort of ruined everything. But he's doing he's good, but you're not going to come away thinking, good Lord, did you see Daniel Radcliffe in that?
Great soundtrack to that clip we just heard. Was the director successful in kind of creating the atmosphere of that period?
I think so. I did enjoy the film. It is a very, like I say, very sticky, sweaty, you really feel it. But it's kind of, I get the sense that Hollywood is forever trying to get it right with the beat parts. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously they spent 5,000 years trying to make On the Road, and finally they did, and no one really cared because it's just too late. And I don't know, this film is done quite well, and it's got its moments, and everyone's pretty good in it. But you kind of think, all right. Enough now of the beat films. It feels kind of unnecessary.
It makes you wonder, because obviously the beat generation was so consumed with taking drugs and exploring, and there are some you know, deeply hallucinatory experiences that they're all involved with, especially William Burroughs. You just wonder why they're ever going to bother to try and put that on screen. Let's move on to Homefront, a little action thriller written by a little action hero.
little old Stallone.
What's that? Tell us the plot of Homefront, and whether you think it's in this
week. My God. The plot of Homefront. Do I have to say these words?
Yes, I'm afraid you do.
Let's begin with Jason Statham. What more do you need to know? He's a retired DEA agent who goes to a small town to get away from everything. Guess what? Doesn't quite work out like that. Naughty motorcycle people and drug dealers and people from his past come back to haunt him.
And Stallone actually wrote the screenplay for this.
Yep. Stallone's written
effect?
A lot of...
you brought this to our attention, this film.
I did.
We need you to talk to us about why.
Well, why is the question. It's actually amazing because it's a preposterous film, which is very entertaining in parts. It's a lot of fun. It's really absurd because you've got James Franco in it, clearly kind of having a laugh because he hasn't done a Jason Statham film before. I like that about Franco. I mean, everything he does is like something that he hasn't done before. And he's the best thing in it, and he is undeniably magnetic. Winona Ryder is in it, just looking completely bedraggled, just, you know, adding another odd choice to her a strange, slow comeback. But you just think it's like one of those B-movie action films from the mid-80s that you just don't see anymore for good reason. And it's kind of befuddling why it exists and why it's been greenlit and why all these people are in it. It's a lot of fun, but it lets itself down most of the time by ridiculous cliches and just the most corny nonsense, and you can only laugh. There's a lot of fun to be had in there, but you do watch it thinking, how does this exist? Why are these people in it? Why was it greenlit? And I think it just must have something to do with Stallone's enormous success with The Expendables that sort of makes him think that it still is 1986.
Let's have a listen to this gem.
Dad?
Yeah?
Why'd we move out here?
Beautiful house, horse trails. What else could we ask for?
I miss Mom.
Me too.
Cool hat, loser.
Give it back.
You want it? Come get it. What you gonna do about it?
No! I want this thing settled, and I mean now. Is that the father, not your girl? You the father?
You've worked up a pretty bad rep around here.
I don't want any more problems.
Tell your little girl she's got nothing to worry about with such a tough daddy around.
I have absolutely no idea what that film is about from that trailer.
Me neither, and I saw it.
Who's it aimed to? Who's it aimed at? Sorry, I must learn to speak English.
It's your Friday night multiplex. Go and watch a film, come out, get a Nando's, and not ever discuss it again. I've got to say, listening back to it, it was fun. There's a lot of stuff to enjoy in it. And I don't really believe in guilty pleasures, but this is a guilty pleasure because it is just rubbish. But, you know, the violence.
On an airplane.
Yeah.
Big play?
No, it's a bit more than that for you. I can see a twinkle, Alex.
No, it was fun. And you think, well, some of this is quite good and Jason Statham isn't that bad. But then every 5 minutes, someone says something so terrible or so awful, you think, oh, Stallone, get over yourself.
Brilliant. Can't wait. Out of the three that we have reviewed today, Alex, Homefront, Kill Your Darlings and Nebraska, which is your absolute must-see?
Homefront. No. Nebraska is a brilliant film. I think Alexander Payne is building up a really fantastic body of work. He's becoming a classic director. And if you've liked anything he's done before, I think you'll really love this.
Alex Godfrey, thank you so much for joining us on The Review. I'm heading straight to see Homefront after this. Stay with us on Monocle 24. Up next, we assess a new exhibition opening in Berlin.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian DeBias, and Emma Nelson. Here at Monocle, we're lucky enough to have correspondents filing for us from all over the world, living as they do in the heart of a city foreign to us but native to them. We love to hear their personal perspective on a cultural event happening in their hood. Today, we turn to Kimberly Bradley, our woman in Berlin.
Long overdue, perhaps, but just in time. On view at last at Kunstwerk Contemporary Art Center in Berlin is a broad-reaching show featuring the work of the late artist Christoph Schliegensief, a man who made his life a kind of Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art. The show covers the controversial artist's two-decade career. It was scheduled a long while back by the former Kunstwerker curator Susan Pfeiffer, but Schlingensief's death in 2010 pushed the plans back. Only now is the show, simply titled Christoph Schlingensief, on view. Here's our Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley's take on it.
Christoph Schlingensief was called a lot of things. A genius, a prankster, a consummate provocateur. But since he died of cancer at age 49 in 2010, he's been mostly called an artist, even if his filmmaking, theater directing, and radical performing made the art world sometimes come closer and sometimes run the other way. Schlingensief was eternally irreverent. His B-movie, German Trilogy, included a segment called 100 Years of Adolf Hitler.
Was heißt hier feiern? Millionen.
At the Documenta exhibition in 1997, his Kill Helmut Kohl poster got him arrested. His staging for the opera Parzival at the Bayreuth Music Festival included dead rabbits. At the premiere, he was loudly booed, but then later lauded as brilliant. Since his death, widow Aino Labyrinth has put together several massive-scale posthumous projects. First was Schlingensief's German Pavilion at the 2011 Venice Biennale, which won a Golden Lion. And then came his opera Village in Burkina Faso, where children have had access to art education and healthcare since spring 2013. And now this. Planned years ago, the Christoph Schlingensief exhibition at Berlin's Kunstwerke Contemporary Arts Center finally opened on December 1st. It is an epic homage to the late artist's vision. In Kunstwerke's courtyard is a small wooden chapel, Schlingensief's Church of Fear, founded in 2003 to consumerize terror.
The Church of Fear helps everyone who failed in believing. The Church of Fear is a community of non-believers.
In the main exhibition space, an installation called an animatograph is a rotating pile of military scrap that visitors can climb on. Around it, actors sit high in tree-like poles, watching. Elsewhere, hours of Schlingensief's film work, both features and documentation of his action art, are on view on monitors and in an in-house cinema. Curated by Susanne Pfeffer and Anna-Katharina Gebers, the Christoph Schlingensief exhibition is not only a parkour, but a look at how German culture, history, and politics were seen and radically critiqued by a man who saw his whole life as a work of art, not unlike his predecessor Joseph Beuys, whom Schlingensief has often been compared to. Schlingensief certainly had his haters, but his work was never boring. I don't always love his trashy aesthetic, but when I see evidence of the 3 decades in which he shook up German culture, I realize the hole his absence has left. He riled us up. He made us laugh. He made us shake our heads. Whether you think this is art or not, Christoph Schlingensief always made us think. For Monocle, in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
And that was Kimberly Bradley reporting to us from Berlin. It is time now for our weekly music review. And today we don't have to go very far to welcome our guest just outside the studio. Monocle's annual Christmas market is in full swing. And music lovers are currently hanging out at the stall of Honest John's, an eclectic music warren of a record store, normally firmly rooted in Portobello, West London.
But for this weekend, he's very kindly packed up some of the best vinyl and CDs he has to offer and set up shop here at Midori House. I'm delighted to welcome back Alan Schofield from Honest John's to the review. You're here to tell us what's on offer outside, but if we are unable to stagger to Midori House for a bit of raclette and a stroke of a reindeer, you've got some beautiful, beautiful stuff in with us today. Alan, it seems like you've gone and explored a brand new area of music which has been around for quite a long time.
Well, yeah, the first track I want to play is from our new release. Well, it's coming out in January, so I think it's the first day that we've actually had it on sale outside here.
And what is the story behind it?
This is a fantastic double CD that my partner Mark put together. By some years of trying, we finally got access to this wonderful thing called the EMI Archive in Hayes in Middlesex, and which stores records that were going back to the 1890s. Basically, there's copies of every record that EMI ever put out, which was EMI's the great English label.
You must have thought that Christmas had come all at once when you walked through that door.
Well, actually, they only let one of us go, and it was Mark's job. And so I only get the stories. But yeah, it's extraordinary because hundreds of thousands of records, not particularly well or in an orderly way, but in a sort of gorgeous disorder. So a polka record will be next to a comedy record, next to a Ghanaian preacher's record, next to some Iranian music, which is the Iranian music is what we want to hear today. The album is 1906 to 1933, so really early music.
What was it that made you stumble across, well, want to focus on Iran, given what was on offer when you went into EMI?
Well, we've done Iraq a couple of years ago, Give Me Love, which is I'm holding, showing you. That was a CD we did. We've done collections of West African music, East African music. We've done compilations from different parts of the world. And I mean, this is wonderful music. Great singing, wonderful musicianship. A lot of the musicians were Jewish. A lot of the singers were women. There was an association with prostitution. If you were a female musician, you were probably a prostitute. That was a sort of common thing. So they used nicknames to try and distance themselves from that. And in fact, the woman who we were going to listen to uses her own name, unusually, which is Malik Zarabi. And this is recorded in 1933, and she actually went into the post-war era and was on a kind of TV star in the 50s and 60s.
Fascinating. Let's have a listen, and then we can talk about it a little more.
yar talabet bin mudendo en kadar az ki tagir qazab natun ke va
Maluk Zarabi there. Daramad Dad is a piece of music that we're listening to. It is a choice of Alan Schofield from Ollis Johns. Alan, it's a voice from the past, isn't it, that makes you stop in your tracks slightly?
It's beautiful music, isn't it? And strikingly good sound, you know, for something that's 80 years old. It doesn't sound like a, you know, dusty old record, does it?
What's she singing about?
I don't know.
What I absolutely...
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm joking. No, I don't know. I asked Mark and he said something so rude that I would not dare mention what he said the song was about. And I believe he was teasing me, so we won't go there.
What I absolutely love, you've brought in the CD, but this is just not any old CD. This is like a book. Inside, you've done extraordinary research and there's the most amazing archive photographs and stories, which for me, I think, is an absolute gift when you listen to music, and especially music like this that has been lost, to be able to look through, pore over archive photographs, being taken into another world, and at your leisure read about what's behind what you're listening to.
I think if, you know, for us running a record label, that it's the way we deal with the shrinking market and everything else. You know, the record was meant to vanish a few years ago. The whole thing was crumbling. I mean, EMI went broke. Our reaction to, you know, that climate was to make things beautiful and interesting. And can I say that there's going to be a 4LP version of this, which will be in a kind of case. So even better and heavier and more beautiful.
Perfect gift for Christmas.
Your second track is Bob Marley.
Yeah. This is a friend of our, Pete, who has a label called Precious Sounds in London, which is specializes in classic reggae, you know, roots from the 60s and 70s. I love this track. I think it's one of the most magical pieces of music. For me, it's like the Goldberg Variations or something. It's Bob Marley before he was signed to Island when became a superstar. He was big in Jamaica, and he did some sessions with the great genius of reggae music, Lee Perry, Scratch the Upsetter. And this is a track called Mr. Music, sometimes known as Rainbow Country. And this is a version that I'd never heard before. Somehow Pete found it on a dub plate. It's scarily good.
Let's have a listen.
Hey, Mr. Music, you sure sound good to me. I can't refuse it. What have you got to be? Dance, 'cause we all free. Got my own in the promised land. I feel at home. Can you understand?
Bob Marley and the Upsetters there, Mr. Music, one of the music choices of Alan Schofield from Honest John's art music reviewer today. Alan, just listening to that, you just think, how often do you stumble across new or undiscovered tracks by Bob Marley? I mean,
yeah.
in your business, it must be like, you know, the Holy Grail.
That does sound to me like the Holy Grail. I don't know. the dread in his voice, the joy and the pain is touches me very deep. You know, it goes very deep. But yeah, I think the interesting thing about the, you know, the business at the moment is that a lot of very rare and unheard music is being put out by lots of small and interesting labels. Just people that are passionate about music. And it's really healthy. There's a lot of digging going on, and it's better than it's been for a long time.
I love that. It's a bit like finding the Rembrandt in the attic. But with your reputation for music, do you find that you get strange emails from people who know about you with gems that they've discovered in an old market stall? Or
It happens, yeah. And quite often it doesn't get anywhere. But, you know, of course, that people are, you know... That's how
they're
a lot of our
collectors,
exactly,
and
a lot of our records have come from just an email. You know, somebody, we put out a record of South African music a few years ago, Shangan Electro, which is fast dance music from the villages. It's crazy. It's kind of a mixture of electronic and rural music, and that was a sort of accident that we just happened to listen to it. Somebody sent us a clip. Are you interested? And it grew into a big deal.
Let's move on to some music from Mali. Mali is. Had enjoyed or did enjoy a real resurgence about 5 or 6 years ago, as lots of interested producers took, you know, really shone the spotlight on it. And, you know, you had the likes of Amadou and Mariam just making huge impressions around the world. And then everybody started going to Mali. And then, of course, the recent problems have obviously shone the spotlight on the country for the wrong reasons. But this is, you know, the culture of Mali and good music has been around for a very, very long time, and your next track tries to show this.
Well, I wanted to, in the light of the problems of the country, I did want to think, bring something that was beautiful and showed the cultural richness. And, we started, Honest John's as a record label, started in Mali. Our first release was called Mali Music.
Why did you choose to go for Mali?
Our friend Damon Albarn, who is known for other things, had gone to Mali with Oxfam in 2000, and he came back with some music, and he made a great big stew in his studio. Brilliant. And he didn't want to release it through EMI. He wanted to, and he was coming into the shop a lot, and we were getting to be friends with him. And one day he said to me, "We should, you know, here I've made this record out of Mali and out of my trip to Bamako, and we should start a label." So with this. And then we went to Bamako with Damon and made a couple of records with Malian musicians. So it's very close to my heart. Bamako is amazing, and the music is everywhere. And the idea that, you know, there's some sort of oppression against music in particular and everything else is really, hideous. But this is music from the golden period, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. It's not clear exactly what date, but... this guy, Zani Diabate, the guitar player and singer, was a dancer. He was in the ballet. And then got into this, what they call the orchestra, the sort of electric bands. And anyway, let's have a listen.
This is track Super Jata de Bamako, is the artist, Bimoko Magnin.
Thank you.
from Mali from the early 1970s. That was super jazz and De Bamako, and beautiful it was too. Alan, our time has sadly passed us with being able to talk about your music today. But if you are, of course, at the Monocle Fair, you can come and have a Monocle Market, should I say? You can come and have a little peruse of your collection. Let's leave with your fourth choice, Blue. I think we're going to listen to it as we talk about it, because not a great deal happens in it. Let's be honest.
It's minimal. But it grows, and we get there in the end.
Let's start things off.
This is Moritz from Moritz von Oswald, a great friend of ours, and sort of central to the label. He does all the mastering of all the music we put out in his studio in Berlin, and sort of godfather of Berlin techno, a legendary guy. And this is a new track that we put out a few months ago, Blue.
Tell us a little bit more about it, because it's not going to do a great deal more than this, is it, for the next 7 minutes?
Moritz is all about sound. And so he makes things so minimal that you start to focus on the kind of the texture. And it picks up. And it comes out of... He had a label in the 90s called Rhythm and Sound, and I guess that's what it's about.
Alan, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Alan Schofield from Honest John's Record, thank you so much for joining us here again on The Review. Always a delight to see you here. Love your music choices. Enjoy the rest of your day at Monocle Christmas Market. Let's hear just a little bit more as we say goodbye to Alan of Moritz von Oswald's track Blue. That was a little excerpt of Blue, Moritz von Oswald, German multi-instrumentalist. And the fourth choice of Alan Schofield from Honest John's Record, who's gone back to man his stall at the Monocle Christmas Market.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back next to hear what's happening in Milan over the coming days.
In Istanbul, they took to the streets in a battle for green space. In Sao Paulo, they marched in their thousands in a fight for cheaper buses. In Athens, they shouted loud to demand a better-run capital. That's why urbanism matters, why words like density, infrastructure, and smart cities need to be dragged out of city hall conclaves and turned into a public debate. And that's why every week, Monocle's show, The Urbanist, reports from cities around the world that are getting horribly wrong and deliciously right, visits the mavericks and mayors with a vision further than the edge of their desk, and ask the questions that will shape how we live tomorrow.
Who governs the city, who owns the city, who has a right to decide what happens in the city?
The bridge becomes an instrument not of moving traffic, but of land development.
There needs to be a voice for the people that says, okay, now we need a library, now we need the green park. These things that are greater than the individual interests.
Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And a warm welcome back. It's Saturday here in London, so you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
And this week, our city look ahead comes from Milan. So here's Monocle's correspondent there, Ivan Carvalho, to guide us through his highlights for the coming days.
December in Milan sees the city light up for Christmas, and the cultural calendar is full of dazzling events for those looking to take a break from holiday shopping in Italy's fashion capital.
It's Christmas time in Italy.
This weekend, the city celebrates its patron, St. Ambrose, and over 400 exhibitors of crafts and food will put out their stalls in front of Sforzesco Castle. Not far from the slices of traditional panettone, the smell of roasted chestnuts, and chants of oibe, oibe, La Scala Opera House will open its season on Saturday night with a performance of La Traviata. For the bicentennial of composer Giuseppe Verdi's birth, the city has ensured that even those without a ticket can listen to the arias. The Vittorio Emanuele shopping arcade will have a big screen showing the performance live, and several local cinemas will offer a live feed and free seating for opera buffs. Those looking to contemplate culture in quieter surroundings can venture over to Palazzo Reale, next to the city's cathedral, where post-war 20th century American art is on display. There's a double bill with works by Jackson Pollock from the Whitney Museum in New York, and a collection of over 160 paintings by Andy Warhol, owned by the prominent collector Peter Brandt, that includes early works like Warhol's flower paintings, and his stab at recreating The Last Supper on canvas. For those curious to see a different take on Jesus and his disciples breaking bread than the one done by Leonardo da Vinci that hangs in the nearby convent of Santa Maria della Grazia. Watch out, the world's behind you. There's always... Over at the Triennale Design Museum, there is the exhibit 100 Years of Practical Madness to celebrate the late Italian creative Piero Fornasetti. A painter turned designer, he dabbled in furniture and making everyday objects from ashtrays to umbrella stands. Over 1,000 pieces from his studio feature in the show, including his signature black ink lithographs and images of his favorite muse, opera singer Lina Cavalieri. For those looking for a quick pick-me-up of culture, this weekend at the Museo Permanente in Via Turati marks the final days of the exhibit dedicated to a staple of Italian design, the Moka stovetop espresso maker. Created 80 years ago by Bialetti, the coffee pot found in every Italian household is shown in its various forms throughout the decades, and there's a step-by-step explanation of the manufacturing process of one of the true icons of Made in Italy. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey, jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. For Monocle in Milan, I'm Ivan Carvalho. La 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 la
la la la. Some cultural treats there from our man in Milan.
This is a review on Monocle 24, as we said earlier. If you were to stray into Midori House here in Marylebone, in the heart of London this week, you will find our courtyard transformed. Outside and in, we have raclette. Raclette outside. Reindeer outside too. Knitwear and vintage, outside and in. But if you've been very good, you might get to sit on a certain someone's knee. He's flown in from Lapland, you know, and his beard is magnificent.
And also standing behind the Lebanese stall, you will find Monocle's Beirut correspondent and friend of our show, Carol Corm, who's taken some time out to pop into the studio to show us the gift she has on offer and to share with us some cultural highlights from the region. Welcome to the review, Carol.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
I love it. You've come with your apron.
Yeah, I took things really seriously.
And the things you have brought in are freezing cold. What's it like out there at the moment?
It is cold, but it's a brisk trade. I'm really happy. We're doing really well, and all our profits go to Syrian orphans in Lebanon and in Syria. So it's for a good cause, and we're kind of, everyone's asking us if we have a store. We're doing well. I'm
well,
happy.
This is the first time we've had a Lebanon stall. We do our winter fair and our summer fair. This is the first time we've had Lebanon, and it looks beautiful. You have the most gorgeous things, and you've brought some in. So I have my eyes on those Christmas decorations, but they're not Christmas decorations as most people know them. Who made them?
So these are little, they're like tiny little pillows made by Palestinian women who are excel at needlework. Something very few people know about Palestine is that they're actually great stitchers and needlework women. So in the camps, there's these associations that get them to work, and they've made these tiny little Christmas decorations, which are really beautiful and much nicer than plastic balls or anything. They take, of course, a lot of time to make, and they're very colorful and very dainty.
When you go about trying to find things, obviously the tiny little cushions, which are exquisite, they're really delightful things. You've obviously gone to great lengths to find something which is not only sort of ethically sound, but is beautiful and is not something that you would find without a little bit of a bit of a hunt. I mean, what's it like going and gathering things for your stall?
Well, I mean, Lebanon's also a bit of a family, you know, family connection. My cousin is Mizrahi, selling the wine at the stall. My aunt is Palestinian, and she has this association that does these works with these Palestinian women. So it wasn't that hard. And then because I work for Monocle, I know a lot of designers, and there's a lot to be highlighted, and it's so negative right now in the region that I really wanted to bring a bit of positivity and cheer and try and continue, you know? We need to continue.
Talk about positivity and cheer. Botchka are designers that just exude optimism and color. And you have a wonderful little, is that a dragon I see before me?
Well, we've decided it could be a dinosaur. We've decided to brand it as a Lebanese dragon. And my friend Omar, who's working with me on the stall, points out that St. George was actually killed the dragon, supposedly in Lebanon, off the Bay of St. George.
At the risk of sounding ignorant, it doesn't look very much like a dragon to me. Can you describe it to us?
This is marketing ploys, Emma, please. It could be. I mean,
it looks like a Datsun with a long tail.
It looks like a dinosaur, come on.
But made up of the most beautiful fabrics. Yeah, that's really what it's all about, isn't it?
It's stitched with all kinds of different fabrics from all over. Some of them are Middle Eastern, some of them are not. And it's from the brand Boksha, which are two very bubbly and dynamic women who do a lot for Lebanese design. They sell at ABC in New York. They're really hip and cool. And they gave these for us for the sale.
It's a pretty little patchwork thing to put in your house, isn't it? About 12 inches long. It looks a little bit like a doorstop, but the one that might run away.
I'm selling doorstops, which I made, by the way, but they're not selling very well.
What else have you got with you? So we have the Lebanese dragon thing.
Yeah.
And then we have food. You're feeding us as well as making our houses look beautiful,
Carol. Of course
I'm
feeding you. I'm getting you drunk as well. You need to come over for
the wine.
After the
show.
Not quite yet.
This is wild thyme from the Baruch Cedar Reserve. So Lebanon is famous for its cedars, but we don't have that many left. And this is the cedar that's picked up from the reserve. And you can use it as a spread, basically, with toast and olive oil. It's a bit like tapenade. It's delicious.
Gillian's just gone straight in.
Open it. You're not supposed to open it. No, I'm kidding.
Someone has
I'm
to
kidding.
Buy that soon.
I'm just trying for our radio listeners to describe the smell, which is like lemon and thyme. Oh.
Yeah, it's delicious.
I'm putting that on,
Emma,
in
I'm sharing it with you.
Thank you.
Divine.
I'm putting that on a piece of grilled chicken straight away. That looks amazing. Amazing. And chock full. And
yeah, if you want to do the Ottolenghi thing at home, you just buy this pot of wild thyme and you put it on everything and it will taste and smell delicious.
You should brand yourself. The new Ottolenghi with that. It's absolutely lovely. Now, we haven't just brought you in to tell us about what you've got on your stall, although that's obviously great for everybody. You are our cultural ambassador as well from Beirut. Let's talk about a book that you've brought in. It's not quite there yet. It's a work in progress. And it is possibly one of the most elegant things I've ever held in my hands. Tell us a little bit more about what we've got.
Well, I've just worked with this famous Lebanese designer who's called Naeem and who's a little bit like the Vidal Sassoon of the Middle East. And he basically has rubbed shoulders with everyone from Bashar al-Assad to King Hussein of Jordan to socialites, movie stars. So I thought that it would be really interesting to tell his life story. It's a much more original way of telling the story of the Middle East in the past 50 years. It's much more glamorous, it's more fun, it's more positive. So this book is kind of his memoirs, it's his life story, but with a lot of fun pictures and these amazing drawings, because when he worked in Saudi Arabia, you obviously could not take pictures of these incredible hairdos. They used to make surreal hairdos for these weddings, and since they couldn't take pictures, he started drawing. So the book is also a collection of the drawings from the hairdresser. It's a very fun and artsy and happy book.
I think it's wonderful because, as you say, there's just, you know, we think of Lebanon and Beirut, of the political troubles. But here you have a hairdresser who in the chair, he has all the best stories of the region.
He does.
And it's like, the, you know, the word of mouth storytelling, isn't it?
It really is. And there's so, such funny stories of holdups and hostage attacks in planes and the hostage takers coming to the salon with their girlfriends after the whole ordeal. The stories are incredible. Or his, one of his aides being kidnapped and him trying to call King Hussein. And so it's a very fun book, and then there's great pictures. So anyone who's remotely interested in the Middle East, I think this is a nice entry into the region.
It's a very entry, and a very elegant entry too. And we wish you the very best of luck with that.
Let's move on to a film. This is something that it's a documentary about the Lebanese contribution to the 1960s space race. Something I was slightly ignorant of until about 5 minutes ago. Tell us a bit more about it.
Well, no one even in Lebanon today knew about this. Basically, it was a group of Armenian college kids in the 60s. It was like a science club. And they started building these little rockets. And then the army started getting interested in what they were doing. And they were successful. And they sent a rocket that went all the way to Cyprus. And and the UN complained. There was a formal
complaint. What about the Cypriots? I think that's about
it. Yeah, the Cypriots complained at the UN. And but Lebanon, this tiny little country that no one takes very seriously, it was all about fun, had these young Armenian geeks who came up with a rocket that was actually...
A viable rocket.
But so bizarre, because if you think at that time, the Americans and the Russians, the propaganda for their nations, they used their rocket science to...
That was the point. And the documentary is very interesting, very fun and witty. And basically, they don't say, but the superpowers asked Lebanon to stop its space program, quote unquote. So the Armenian kids who are now like teachers in Florida in the space... American space.
There's a delightful bit in it where they decide whether what Lebanon might look like in 2025 if the space program had actually happened.
Yeah, the end of the movie turns into a cartoon, and that's really quite cool. Where they show you what if we had done very well and the Lebanese had satellites and space stations.
Carol, we are going to conclude today with a little bit of music. You've straddled every art form. Thank you very much indeed for doing this. This is Yasmin Hamdan, who is a regular on the Monocle 24 playlist. Tell us a little bit more about this piece of music, Yanas.
Yanis is the name of her album. Yasmin Hamdan is the hippie, cool Lebanese singer that actually manages to straddle sexy and witty.
And smart.
And smart. And I mean, she just brings Arabic music to a different level. It's not world music. It's not tacky pop. And it's not too indie. It's just perfect. And I really think people should discover her music more.
And she was writing music when most people, pop singers, were singing in English. She sings in Arabic,
doesn't
she?
Yeah, she's making a point about that because she wants to show people that Arabic can also be modern and young. She's also playing in Jim Jarmusch's movie that's coming out soon.
Let's have a listen.
I'm afraid we have to leave it there. That's all we have time for today's weekly review. So goodbye from us here at Midori House. Do come down to the Christmas market if you can. My thanks to our producer, Katie Bilbao, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Claire Urban.
Next week on The Review, we look forward to discussing some festive theatre with Matt Wolf. But for now, get ready for the Curator Monocle's Best of Radio show, which pulls together the unmissable highlights from the week that was here on Monocle 24. And if you're in London, do drop in to Midori House and enjoy our Christmas market all day today and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m.
But we leave you with Yasmin Hamdan and Yanas. From all of us here on The Review, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. يا وي مزيوني بالطول